time to tune in to the podcast with wise words, glasses on, ears open. Many things you'll learn from industry leaders and permobil experts. Welcome to the point of view of the wheelchair nerds. Extra, extra.
Be the hammer.
You're listening to something great.
I'm great.
You finally arrived at the place.
Welcome to Wheelchair Nerds, a podcast to connect and inform people who utilize, prescribe, and provide seating and wheel mobility equipment. I'm your host, Angie Kiger. Before we jump into today's topic, a brief reminder that the information in this podcast is for educational purposes only and is not intended to be medical, billing, or legal advice. Now, let's get to it.
Welcome, everyone, to this episode of Wheelchair Nerds. We have a really fun and exciting guest, and I can't wait to have this great conversation with her and Angie. And Angie, I'm going to let you introduce Lisa here.
Absolutely. So I am pumped. Lisa Kenyon is a longtime friend of mine. Lisa, you probably don't remember this, but I remember the first time we met was I actually was sitting doing a presentation at one of the International Seating Symposiums, and I quoted her research on the board, like on the big screen. And I look out of the audience, I make eye contact with her, it's like, huh, Lisa's sitting in here. That's funny. And so then afterwards, she came up and talked to me. And when you are a newer wheelchair nerd in the industry and you're speaking at big events, and because at least I'm sure you've had moments like this too, where you get intimidated, like, oh my gosh, so-and-so is in the audience. Well, Lisa, you were one of those so-and-sos for me. And then it created a long friendship. We have done, Lisa has successfully, Hawken, been the only person to convince me to do research with. We did research during the pandemic together, so I am published thanks to Lisa. So I'm excited to have another one of my friends on here. And I think it's really cool that Hawken, you're on here too, because you are someone who uses a power wheelchair. You have a congenital diagnosis, where is that congenital? Kind of. I have to think about that. But Duchenne, as far as you know, grown up with that, and Lisa's worked with a number of clients too over her career. And pediatrics is how we bonded. So Lisa, I've teased you enough. You're already on camera for anybody who's watching the YouTube recording of this. Who are you? What do you do? And give me your 30-second elevator pitch, if you will, on who you are.
Wow. Well, I'm so honored to be here today. Thank you guys so much. I fangirl quite a bit over you, Angie, so I think we might be equally fanning there. So I'm Lisa Kenyon. I'm from Grand Valley State University in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and I'm a physical therapist. Work with children. It's just such a joy and a delight for me to be able to work with children and their families and to help my students and the others around me, like when I'm presenting at conferences, and that to see some of the joy that I experience every day when I work with children. It's just so exciting.
Awesome. I love it. So, you know, one thing I've never asked you, Lisa, is why did you become a PT? Like what even got, you know, we've known each other through the world of presenting, like conferences at ISS and research, but what got you wanting to be a PT?
Well, it's kind of one of those odd stories. So remember, I'm really old. So the internet was not around when I was in high school. Right? And I really wanted to work with children. I'd done some work with children with cerebral palsy, some volunteer work. I really enjoyed it. And I thought I wanted to be a special ed teacher. But being, you know, a teenager, I wanted to go to college away from home, right? Mm-hmm. And the University of Maine in Orono has a really great special education program. It was only an hour and a half from my house, and I didn't want to go that close. And so one of my friends in high school said, well, why don't you be a physical therapist? They work with children. I was like, great, I'll be a physical therapist. And that's how it all happened. And what a really wonderful happenstance. You know, I couldn't be more happy to be a pediatric PT and all the wonderful experiences I've had as a pediatric physical therapist and all the great children and families I've had the pleasure of getting to know. It's just amazing.
Awesome. So tell us a little bit about the different populations that you worked in. Like I know now you're in academia and we'll get to that, but what was the road leading you towards academia and research?
So I was a full-time clinician for over 20 years before I went back and got my PhD. And I've worked in just about any pediatric setting that you can think of, because oftentimes I worked for an employer that would contract me out. We used to say we were rent-a-therapist, but they would contract me out to other institutions or programs or things like that. So I've done school-based therapy, so Boston Public Schools. I've done rural schools. I've done Department of Defense schools. I've worked in pediatric hospitals, in inpatient, in the PICU, in the NICU. I've done quite a lot of work in the NICU. I've done outpatient. I started my own private practice. I've Wow. done special programs in terms of, like, I worked in a classroom once where our entire emphasis was on helping the children communicate using augmentative and alternative communication. Sorry about that. I sometimes trip up on those words. I was doing all sorts of access work and positioning work. And I've even worked in pediatric rehabilitation centers, inpatient rehabilitation centers, which are few and far between, and a pediatric nursing home and early intervention and home health. I think I've done just about all.
Haven't you worked, right? Yeah. I think a lot of people might not realize the fact that you've touched on long-term care for pediatrics. I think a lot of times people don't realize, you know, that those institutions are out there. They are. We've got, you know, a few around DC metro area back at the hospital where I used to work, HSC Pediatric Center, formerly Hospital for Sick Children, was purchased by Children's National since I left. So they changed their name. I can't remember. Sorry, my friends who still work there, but listen, I can't remember the new name, but we had a long-term care unit. And that was very common as far as having kids that were more of on a maintenance program, just really kind of keeping them more, decreasing contractures. Those kiddos always found to be interesting because I love to look at a kid and to see what they were purposely able to do that nobody realized that they could. And I would think to myself, I wonder if they can drive. So with that question, Lisa, what is the youngest kiddo that you've attempted to try to move on their own, whether it be through power, whether it be through manual? Because we're going to talk a lot during this podcast about on-time mobility. I know it's one of your passions. So
yes, I'm so grateful for Andrina Savitt and her colleagues for introducing the world to the framework on on-time mobility. So the youngest child I have ever worked with of power was 5.5 months old, and I was in the neonatal intensive care unit. He was one of our long-termers, and I asked the physicians if I could try it, and they were like, sure. And so I had him with a little proximity switch driving around the nursing station. It was really exciting. And, you know, I think that when we're looking at children, oftentimes as therapists and clinicians who work in wheelchairs, we think, okay, what are the reasons that they can't do this, that they can't try power? And that little boy really taught me that all you needed was a stable airway, because I had been approached by some of the staff about trying him earlier, and he had not yet had his trach placed, so his airway wasn't stable. And I was like, no, I don't think he's ready. And they said, what? You don't think somebody's ready? And I was like, yeah, I think you need a stable airway before you can do this. And it was a real revelation to me that really, you do have to worry about some things, but it's medical things like stable airway. And did we have a way to take his vent with us and things like that? So it's, I learned a lot from that young man. And just that simple act also made all the nurses and doctors look at him differently, because he could do something that they didn't expect. And he was really made some nice progress.
That's great. As a journalist, I always want to ask follow-up questions, because this gets really curious. Like, so you mentioned you had a stable airway and you had a switch set up. How exactly did you set that up and to achieve that result?
So here at Grand Valley State University, I have the privilege of leading with my colleague, Dr. John Ferris from GVSU's Engineering School. I have the privilege of working on the Grand Valley Power Mobility Project. And we work with engineering students and physical therapy students to design and build different mobility devices. So that was actually our little kid's device that child used. So we call it our play and mobility device. We've kind of left it on the shelf here in the last few years just because we've been a little busy doing other types of projects. But yeah, it's just a motorized platform with a car seat on it that we could adjust the angle of the car seat, make it so that his, because he didn't have much in the way of head control, make so that he was reclined a little and supported. And I just took the proximity switch and put a little bit of Velcro on the back of it so it would stick to the receiving blankets that the nurses packed around him. And, you know, kind of just started in that way.
Totally relate to that. As he got closer to that proximity, he would go forward.
We set it so it was fairly sensitive, and then we kind of backed it off a little bit. But he didn't have a whole lot of volitional movement, just related to his condition. And so, we were really intentional, and his eyes would get really big at first. And we also set it so that it had a auditory feedback, so he would know when he had activated it. And he, really smart little guy, he learned it so fast. It was just a wonderful way to provide him with some opportunities to explore and do things.
I think a lot of times people would be surprised to know that those of us who are, you know, as I'm aging, I used to, feel like I was on the cusp of early pediatric power mobility. But now as I'm aging, I think a lot of people would be surprised that before we had the internet connected, before email, before all these big conferences, a lot of us were doing similar things in different locations. And luckily, some folks decided to research it and really put pen to paper so we could tell these stories and show insurance companies that, hey, these can be paid for. I mean, Hawk, I think about one of the first kiddos that I got into a trial very similar to Lisa's. She was what we called the hospital for a little while, a frequent flyer. She was one of those kiddos that we knew she had SMA prior to her diagnosis. Once she was diagnosed, she came back to us and she was around 8 months old. And I remember we were in our playroom at the hospital and we had her in a tumble form chair. Lisa, the little tumble form, it's a very passive seat, Hawk. And she's just sitting there watching. And it was one of those moments where an 8 month old, she looked at me, looked at the kid crawling, looked at me, looked at the kid crawling. It was kind of like, I want to do that. And you could just tell. And I knew from her diagnosis with SMA, is typically those kiddos are well above their peers of the same age in terms of cognition. And so I was like, I bet she can do this. And similar to Lisa, it's like finding out what is that little movement to let them have success in order to be able to drive. And I think that's key, is really giving kids the chance.
Definitely.
I do have, a question. We're talking about on-time mobility for those who kind of haven't heard of that terminology before. What exactly does that mean, and what time is on time?
That's a great question. And again, all of this information is available in Andrina's article in Pediatric Physical Therapy, the Physical Therapy Journal. And it is, I believe it's 2021 that was published. But really, on-time mobility is a rights-based approach to mobility. That idea that all children have the right to be mobile, and all children have the right to be mobile at the same time as their peers are mobile. And there are different principles of on-time mobility. There's five in the outlined in the article, but the first is the one I always talk about, and that's timing. And we should be offering children mobility experiences and other experiences at the same time as their typically developing peers. So in this way, what we've traditionally thought about in rehab as early power mobility, and we know from some studies that we've done and others have done that term early means 2 years of age, that we're actually providing early power mobility way too late. So that idea of intentionally providing it on time, at the right time for that child and that family as well. The other thing that I think is important is that idea of urgency. A lot of times in the traditional biopsychosocial model, we want to sit back and wait. Let's just wait and see what happens. Well, the typically developing child doesn't wait and sit back and say, well, let's wait and see what happens if I don't try to move. We encourage them. We get them going. We set up the environment. Well, it's the same that needs to be done for the children that are having mobility delays or restrictions. We really need to urgently get them these experiences as soon as possible. We know that work by others in psychology and other fields shows us that there's a developmental cascade that occurs in typically developing children. When they start to crawl, when they start to walk, all of their other areas of development just go wild, and they just start tumble-storming, you know, kind of snowballing is what I think of it, and just this huge cascade of changes and growth and development across all areas. And for the children who we work with, who have mobility delays and limitations, we need to be offering that same thing. And that self-initiated mobility might look a little different, right? It might be a power device. It might be a manual mobility device. It might be a combination of things, which leads us to the third principle, which is multimodal. We don't just think about this as power. We think about it as mobility would be appropriate for this child. You know, you and I don't use just one form of mobility typically. As adults, we might use a car, we might, you know, we might walk, we might use a power wheelchair. Children need choices too. And we could think about many things, like we could think about a power device that's adapted to meet their needs at that small stage. There's some commercially available devices, but there's also modifying our ride-on toy cars. There's some manual devices that are available. In fact, one of the projects that we've worked on within the last 12 months or so is we found online through a CBS Morning News segment, we found online these plans to make a little tiny wheelchair. It's like it's supposed to be a toddler wheelchair. And we actually have made several of them and are using them with some children here in our community, but they're really cute. They weigh less than probably about 13 pounds. Oh, they're really tiny. I mean, they got a little handle on the back and I can just pick it up real easily. So families really like that aspect. And it doesn't cost very much to put together and make either. We figure for us, it's about a little less than $200 each. Some of the parts are 3D printed and stuff like that. We actually have named our version of it the Mini Maverick or the Mini Mav because we found that a lot of our families were like, we don't want a wheelchair. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, that's a good point, but would you like a Mini Mav? Oh, why, yes, I would. And I think we have to be really sensitive to that idea that, unfortunately, in our society, especially for young children, that term wheelchair has a real anxiety-provoking meaning for a lot of our parents. And so we intentionally chose the idea of Mini Maverick, or for short, the Mini Mav, because a maverick is fiercely independent. And we also kind of did a little bit of Tom Cruise thing there.
There you go.
Maverick. So that belongs in that idea of multimodal. Gait trainers, you know, harness systems, track systems belong in that. So there's just a whole lot of things that belong there. And the other part that sometimes we as therapists kind of forget about, I think, is that idea of having the frequency of practice and use of mobility in everyday settings and environments, and try to think about our dosage there. You know, the typically developing child is walking 7.7 football fields when they're, you know, 18 months of age. Well, we probably can't get that much practice for our kids, but we really can think about how we can help work in mobility to routines within the home so that the children are getting more opportunities for that. And then finally, that idea of sociability. And this is something that I really love. So it's the idea that the typically developing child is mobile within social situations, typically like first with their family and then with their friends and things. And I love that idea of situating socialization and social activities with mobility, because that's kind of really natural. As a pediatric physical therapist, I've always had that idea of let's involve the family in the session. I've not been one to have the family sit out in the waiting room and, you know, I am in the back with the child, and I like to involve the siblings and everything, and just creates a very rich and natural environment when we can do that. So those are the five principles of on-time mobility. And I've just really embraced these concepts from my colleagues, and so glad they brought them forward. So that was Andrina, as well as Heather Feldner, Sam Logan, Cole Galloway, and I think that's all of them. I'm sorry if I've left somebody off, because that's just such a wonderful piece of a wonderful framework that now we can bring forth. And we've been putting together several different research studies kind of focused on that on-time mobility in action.
Yeah, it's one of the most important, I would say, things that we talk about with young families. I had a situation, so a good friend of mine that I grew up with since middle school, he now lives over in the UK. And a couple of years ago, actually during the pandemic, I was pondering doing something different with my career. And so saw that he worked for Google and saw his brother did too. Long story short, reached out to them, heard back from his older brother, but didn't hear back from John. Well, it turns out John's wife had had twins at 24 weeks gestational age. And so they were very much in the, oh my gosh, we've got these little tiny preemies. And so being able to have that discussion with John very early on, because one of his boys was delayed with this, was with his crawling, sitting up, all of the things that we expect for somebody who's was born at 24 weeks gestational age. And he had never heard of this concept. He had fantastic clinicians that he was linked with over in the UK, but had never heard of this. So we actually did a Zoom call or a Teams call with Amy Morgan, and I talked with him about it, just giving him some basic ideas. And the win at the end of the day for that one, you know, for this family, is he is able to independently move around. And I won't say it's a win simply because he's primarily doesn't have to use any piece of equipment. But the fact is he was able to stay along with his brother really at the same developmental level. And that's the thing that really articulating that to families, talking, if you ever go with me to an abilities expo, you'll see me on a little mini crusade about that. Oh, and it's something I don't get a chance to talk about a lot within my work now at Permobile, because I think it's so, so important. You know, just because you're trying a power chair now or a power device like the Explorer Mini does not mean that you're never going to ambulate independently. Right.
Or that you might not ambulate at some point in time and use wheeled mobility of some sort at other points in time. Again, that idea of it's not just an either or. What can we do as an industry? What can we do to help with providing information and research for funding sources to see that there's benefits in having both?
For sure. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's something we run into a lot with guys who do Shen like me, where, you know, the wheelchair, it's like this big transition and people don't want to do it. But I think it really does give freedom and peace of mind to you, because you're not worried about a fall or anything like that. But at the same time, like you said, Lisa, there's this perception of like a wheelchair is kind of this bad thing. So I'm curious how much that plays into working with families and getting kids in power chairs and how you kind of overcome that.
Yeah, that's a great question to talk about. And I don't think there's one right recipe that works. I try to be really upfront with parents and really talk to them about some of these benefits that they can have, the children can have, that the parents can experience, and, you know, plant seeds. So when I talk to a parent about something, they might not be ready for it, but I planted a seed, and then maybe somebody else talks to them about it, and they, that seed gets water and so on and so forth until it blossoms. I had a mom of a, I think he just turned 17. That really makes me feel old. But when he was three, I was talking to mom and dad about the idea that, you know, he had a cerebral palsy and he was GMSCS level four, gross motor function classification system level four, and what that meant, and what that meant for, you know, predictively for his future mobility. And they weren't ready to hear it. I just kept on talking every time I saw them for equipment or a episode of care. I would talk about it and plant those seeds and plant those seeds. I got a phone call from mom just a few days ago. Oh gosh, it's probably a couple of weeks now. My time does fly, but it, just within the last couple of weeks. And she was like, you know, I heard what you were saying. I just wasn't ready to listen to it. And thank you so much for planting those seeds, because they made some different decisions in terms of the layout of their house, in terms of their vehicle, in terms of mobility options for their child, not just trying to restrict him to one, but looking into, we have an equipment program here called Renew Mobility, where they take in gently used equipment, clean it all up, and loan it back out to people. And they teach children how to use the equipment. It's also for adults, but I use it mostly with my kids. And they had gotten several things, like they'd gotten a manual wheelchair firm through there, an adaptive bicycle, tricycle, with their, and so they were really looking at that idea of multimodal and taking it throughout. And I just found it very interesting that mom reached out to tell me this. And it really is that seed. And I didn't think that I'd really ever gotten, you know, to the point of them really listening to what I was saying. But somewhere that seed was planted, and then it was watered and watered and watered. And they were finally able, and he's doing really great. He's, of course, moving in different ways than other children who are 17. But, you know, he is doing so many things, and he wants to be a lawyer. And I think he could probably talk his way out of or into anything. So it's really fun to see.
That's awesome. That's awesome. So I know one of the things, Lisa, that parents would struggle with, and also clinicians would struggle with, is what are some practical resources? Like, what if we've got somebody who's listening to this? We see this a lot when you work in a clinic, or is that school therapists? This happened in numerous conversations just last week. I was up at the New Jersey, New York Metro, New Jersey Abilities Expo, basically. It's held in Jersey. And I had therapists come up to me, these two in particular that I recall, they worked for a pediatric agency. So they went to the homes and they were saying, oh yeah, you know, we see a lot of kids that would be appropriate for power, but I don't even, like, how do I even start with them? So even power or manual, what are some low tech ideas that you've come across that can be implemented?
You know, these equipment loan programs at different points in the country, you know, I've never lived where there was such a large and organized equipment loan program as I do here in the greater Grand Rapids, Michigan area. But it's absolutely amazing. You know, families can go in and there's actually an OT that works for the organization. It's a nonprofit, and she makes sure everything is safe and working, and they can at least try some things. Mm-hmm. We also are very fortunate. We have a seating and wheel mobility clinic here. So in all the years that I was a therapist, I never really lived close to a seating and mobility clinic. So I always had to do my own, because that's what we all did as therapists. We all did our own. And so we have a really great clinic here. But I do think that, you know, like our service arm of our Grand Valley Power Mobility Project, I get calls from people all the time. Can we come in and try your device? Can you bring your device out to my home? Can we do this? We try as much as we can to get those options for the children, because that's what our service arm of our project is all about. Of course, you know, when we're doing a lot of research, unfortunately, we have less time for the service arm because we only have so much time. But it's, I think that that idea of just trying it. Mm-hmm. And I have found throughout my career that I could easily call up the rep of the different companies or several places where I work. We'd have like an independent company that worked with all of the different manufacturers. And I would just call them up and say, hey, I want to try this with a child. What can you do for me? And it might take him a while to get something, but we could try it. And one of the things we're working on here is a device that temporarily converts the child's manual wheelchair or adaptive stroller into a power device. Oh, nice. We're starting with, we use it with children as young as 3, but most of our children younger than 3 don't have their own device. And we can adjust the width of it. We can adjust the length of it. And it's more compact than our previous power wheelchair still trainer, which was quite a monstrosity in its own right. But it worked, right? And it gave families an idea of what might be possible and gave children a way to move and explore. So we do a lot of work with children who are driving to learn and learning from their driving versus learning to drive a power wheelchair. So driving to learn versus learning to drive. Now we have quite a large arm on either side because of our current research project. But again, it's that idea of let's try, let's see. Mm-hmm. And thinking about how we can provide those experiences. I can't tell you how many modified ride on toy cars that we have done. Oh, yeah. And we do, you know, there's issues with them, you know, that stop, go, stop, go, stop, go is kind of somewhat limiting, but it's better than nothing. And newer things like the Explorer Mini. And I know that, you know, we're looking at other devices within, working with our engineering students here and making, you know, just, we're not manufacturing anything, but we're just making like, you know, small devices. We're looking at that. And I know different manufacturers are looking for coming back to those smaller wheelchairs mm-hmm. that were so popular, gosh, number of years ago, and then kind of came off the market and are coming back. So I would say, you know, try, because the worst that can happen is it doesn't work. I'm a big one to try something or to ask for something, because you ask for something, the worst somebody can say is no. And mm-hmm. if you try something, as long as you keep the child safe, that's really about it. I do think that sometimes it's hard for clinicians to know where to start with the actual training once the mm-hmm. child has a device. And, you know, I've done a lot of different training over the years without really knowing what I was doing. So gosh, back in the 80s, those poor children that I was working with, 80s and 90s, right? But I was actually not knowing it. I was doing a lot of the same principles for that, you know, the driving to learn program and helping the children to learn from their use of the power chair. And then some of the children went on to be able to have their own individually prescribed power chair. And now I really direct clinicians to the assessment of learning powered mobility use, which of course mm-hmm. is both an assessment and an intervention package, because it has facilitating strategies that you match the child's exact phase and stage of learning to the facilitating strategies. I guess you actually match the facilitating strategies to their exact stage and phase of learning. But it really supports their learning. We're having a really fun time and getting some great results looking at that in our current research project. And I just think that the work that Lisbeth Nielsen and Josephine Durkin amazing. Did to create that is just a huge gift. And I've been slowly unpacking that since it came out in 2014, and I'm getting a little better at it, but I'm certainly not, and I'm not Lisbeth Nielsen, that's for sure. But like anything, you have to practice with it. And it's not a, you know, drive 10 feet and turn right type of protocol. We're not teaching the children tasks. We're supporting their learning. So once you get that idea, I love that the ELF lets me be the therapist that I want to be. I can create those engaging activities that meet the child exactly where they're at, that they want to do, that they're working really hard and don't even realize that that's what they're doing. So I think that that is something that I've been trying to do more sessions on and more teaching on. Again, if you're able to learn from the master, Elizabeth Nielsen, that's obviously the best. You know, I've been really trying to spread that idea. And I do use the wheelchair skills program out of Dalhousie. I'm actually part of that group as well. But I find that a combination of those things works well, especially once the child understands how to basically operate the power wheelchair, because the one thing the child needs to be able to do before they can do the task, drive forward 10 feet and turn left or turn right or whatever, they have to have an idea of how the device operates. And that's where I think the ELF really excels.
I agree. You're making me, it's funny because Hawk never knew this side of me. He's only known me for a year. You're making me miss being in clinics, teaching the protocols that we use for a decade at HSC. And you know, some of the low tech things that we did is I called it Flintstoning. And so what we would do is her name was Cerise. It was a young woman we worked with, and she should have been driving a power wheelchair long before she actually came in for an evaluation. And she had gotten to the point where she knew she was in control of the situation. She wasn't going to move, and she was nonverbal. The only way we were able to convince her to work, because we had to discharge her. We're like, you know what? She's not making any gains, Mom. Sorry. Her mom said, no, she can do this. I know she can. Like, oh, we 100% were with you, but she's got to show us something in order for us to be able to sign off on this. So she said, what do you recommend? And I said, well, I know she's working on directions with you, right? And so basically, Hawkins, she went, Mom took her to a mall. I gave her this recommendation, said, take her to a mall. What's one of her favorite things? Well, she likes to go into Claire's to buy earrings and girly stuff with her sister because she was a preteen. And I said, okay, you don't move Cerise. She was in a manual wheelchair. It could not propel herself. You don't move Cerise until she either touches something on her lap tray that said go, like point forward, or she pointed where she wanted to go. Other than she has to initiate something. But you've got it. Anytime you lay that overlay on her tray, that is her driving device. That's her motor. So basically, if she touches it, there's got to be somebody behind her ready to move her. So she learns to carry that over. And it was, you know, it was something as basic as that. And I'm going to tell therapists that. They're like, what? That worked? I said, yeah. The motor has to be quiet. Like, shut up. Don't say anything. And, you know, especially working with kiddos with cerebral visual impairment was key. And I missed that side of, you know, now that I've moved into the side of the industry, I know that I'm having the chance to do a lot of great things, develop a lot of great content and get it out to the masses, which is one of the reasons we do the podcast. But you make me miss it. I mean, Lisa, if we could think of a reason for me to come up there and hang out in clinic with you one day. And
I would certainly love that, Ange. It would be great.
And there's just a lot of things, you know, setting the kiddos up so they're not going to hurt themselves. Another big thing I'll never forget, another mutual friend of ours, Jenny Paleg, and I, I was teaching at a class one day and she came up to me. I had somebody who was attending the CEU class came up to me afterwards. It's like, hey, I've got an issue. I've got this kiddo who I know he can drive. I know he can do it. She's like, he just runs into walls all the time. I know he does it on purpose. And so Jenny and I actually, for a hot second, we disagreed. I was very proud of myself for standing my ground. And I said, in all honesty, I said, I think you need a behavior modification for this young man. And Jenny's like, no, he needs to be able to explore to learn, because this is right when Elizabeth's stuff first started coming out. And I said, I hear you. This kid's smart enough to know. He's playing this therapist, and you've got to teach him behavior. Like, you cannot do that. And I think that sometimes on some kids who fail or are deemed as unsafe, it's because they're being a kid, right? Yeah. Like, you know, another one. I'll breathe in 1 second, but my other favorite story, talking about siblings, I will never forget, never, ever, ever, ever forget my career. I had a kiddo I was working with, and her older sister, understandably, struggled with the fact that the younger sister got more attention. They were constantly going to therapy. So the older sister was kind of a pressure, kind of annoying, if we're just being honest. And I will never forget when we finally successfully set the younger sister, who was our patient, up with a head array, and she could drive appropriately. Sister pinned her up against, little sister pinned big sister up against the wall. And because what happened was, is big sister kept basically running her mouth. Little sister kept it going and made it so that the foot plates, the little girl like spread her legs. I mean, so the foot plates like went in between her legs up against the wall, and big sister looked like this. And her mom didn't get mad at her. She's like, I think your little sister's been wanting to do that her entire life. Like, she's been dying to do that. She just was cracking up. So got to be safe. Yeah. At the same time, kids are going to be kids.
Definitely. Well, one of the things that I think, you know, and again, I'm in this process of evolving how I've approached power wheelchair skills training. But one of the things about the ALP that I've really tried to take to heart is that idea about within the confines of safety and at the end of the session, because not every child wants to follow things at the end of the session and actually go home. I try to follow the child's initiatives, and I make it like something that's not a big deal at all that they're running into something. And we just kind of sit there when, you know, don't make it a big deal. And eventually, if I don't get upset, if I'm coaching the parent, don't get upset, child moves on from it. Mm-hmm. We had a little boy last fall who wanted to do the paper towel dispenser, the automatic paper towel dispenser in the restroom. He had a child who'd never been able to like get into toddler trouble. So even though he was, I believe, 6, he just had never had that opportunity to be able to get into trouble. And we had gone into the ladies' room. He'd driven in to wash his hands because they'd gotten soap on them or something from the bubbles or whatever. And we were washing our hands, and he figured out that the paper towel holder gave paper towels. Yeah. And he wanted to play at that and play at that and play at that and play at that. And I'm thinking in my mind, oh my gosh, I could be training. I'm not doing anything. Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. How long is this going to last? And it probably lasted a good 15 minutes before he decided that he was done. But I think what he learned was that, gosh, when I move myself in this wheelchair, I can go do things that I want to do and I can explore. And we actually just got word last week that he has received his own individually prescribed power wheelchair after failing, quote unquote, failing this driver test for power wheelchairs twice and being named an unsafe driver. And after kind of working, and he's a hard worker, and so I'm giving all the credit to him. But, you know, what a fun thing to see. And I could see my students going, okay, Lisa, we're just standing here watching him do that. And I tried to get him, they're like, okay, do you want to put him in the trash can? Nope. Yep. Okay. But this was great. And another thing he liked to do is push buttons. Like, so he wanted to go on the elevator, mm-hmm. Push the buttons, get off the elevator, push the buttons, turn on the elevator. But if you think about that, that's a great activity. He's getting mm-hmm. on and off and turning. And I put people in the elevator. I put chairs in the elevator, making the task harder for him. You know, backing into the elevator rather than just, you know, pulling in and turning around. All these different things. And I now, you know, kind of joke that I probably have 101 things that you can do while getting on and off an elevator, right? And make them into a game for the child. But I you know, I think that, you know, my husband's really big into behavior modification and his work. So I do think that there's a place for things like that as well. Mm-hmm. But I think that oftentimes as adults, we forget, like you said, that these are children who've never had that control. Mm-hmm. And so if we try to maybe kind of approach it from the, oh, this is new to them, this is an experience for them, then maybe they'll just kind of get sick of that and move on to the next thing. We'll have to see how it all works out. But I've been really pleased with having that kind of allowing approach, of course, within safety. You know, some of the children want to do some things like, oh, look, there's some stairs. Let's go drive down. That's not saying we're not going to do that.
Yeah.
I'm curious how you balance that safety. And I was just thinking, like, have you guys thought about a simulator or something along those lines that allows them to practice without physically interacting with their environment literally and running into things and such?
I mean, there's some work out of Montreal with the Montreal. Is it Montreal or Quebec? I think it's a Montreal. It's a simulator. There's a simulator that's been used in a number of different things. There's, you know, immersive virtual reality simulators. For me, I think those things are awesome for children who have that basic understanding of, you know, cause and effect and can tolerate all that sensation. A lot of the kids I work with are not able to tolerate that, and they're not at that point where they could even begin to think about looking at something on the computer screen and making something happen. And I like the fact that we're kind of entering into this world right now where we have different options. You know, we don't just have one size fits all anymore. We're getting so many different options. And, you know, for some children, that idea of that simulator, that virtual reality might work really great. For other children, they might need that actual movement. And it, to me, what a great time to be in this field because we have all these different options. And I just love that.
Absolutely. And there's something about the movement. So many of the children that I worked with had cerebral palsy, and a bonus to getting cerebral palsy a lot of times is a cerebral visual impairment. And so being able to see the screens it's really difficult.
Definitely.
Like I was this close to having a little guy that I met this weekend try a power chair. And when mom picked him up from his stroller, put him in a little power chair that was going to fit him this weekend, he started crying and losing his mind. And I squatted down right next to him, and he wasn't more than a year old. And I was talking to mom, and I was like watching this little boy. He kept closing his eyes. And I said to his mom, I said, by any chance, does he have CVI? And she said, oh, he does. And I said, okay, well, then we're going to stop. Like, we didn't even try. I said, because this is a whole new environment. He can't process what's happening around him. I said, this is not a process. I've taught many kids with CVI to drive a power wheelchair. I'm going against my own protocols by trying it here. But here's a referral. Like, I encourage you to go call these therapists. Like, this is, you need to try this for sure. But yeah.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much that's out there now, and that I wish that more people would become open to it. But Hawk, you hit the nail on the head earlier as far as like talking with the families. It's a one-on-one conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And some meet families who are very receptive, who are like, yep, like this little boy's mom was like, oh, I know. And I had a feeling, I inferred this based on the conversation with them, is that mom had been on board the whole time, and maybe dad was dragging his feet a little bit. When I started to explain to mom about what, you know, just any sort of attempt to try an adaptive device, whether it's a manual wheelchair, or power wheelchair, whatever for their son, she was like, oh yeah, she heard it all. And the father was very leaned in, is very inquisitive. And when I explained the whole, you know, it's not just about mobility and using a wheelchair, it affects overall development. We start talking about how, oh yeah, I do notice he gets frustrated. He cries a lot. And so it could be because he can't move. He can't communicate, those sorts of things. So sometimes it just takes hearing from a different voice. And so I spent so much of my career educating clinicians. Now I feel like I'm on like a new mission to educate caregivers and educate end users more about the evaluation process. So
awesome.
Whole point of the podcast.
more of a practical question, I guess, is, you know, maybe a family, you know, has a little one that needs some help with mobility. Where do they start with that process of, you know, power wheelchair, manual wheelchair? Because I have to guess this idea of on-time mobility is not as pervasive as we'd want it to be. So I guess, you know, if someone is interested in doing that, what would be the next steps for them?
You know, most children in the U.S. would have a therapist either at school if they were school age, or in early intervention if they were in that birth to their third birthday range. And I think it's always great to start with somebody who knows your child. But I also encourage parents to advocate for what they feel their child needs, because mm-hmm. sometimes therapists aren't as in tune with these concepts of mimicking the experiences of typically developing children and providing those mobility experiences and positioning experiences at times when you typically would be seeing their typically developing peers do that. So to me, I think that it's a place to start. We have so many great families that are doing a lot of great advocacy things and providing a lot of voice for the communities. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I see it all the time. You know, parents will reach out to me and like, Mom, my therapist said that if I went ahead and do this, my child's never going to walk, but I really think that this is going to help them. And, you know, we talk about the literature, and the literature strongly indicates, you know, the lower level of evidence, but enough of it to just kind of put it all together, that this is not something that's going to deter development. It's actually going to help it. So in a recent study that Heather Feldner led for us all, so it was Heather Feldner at the University of Washington, Sam Logan out at Oregon State University, along with Bethany Sloan, and then myself, we did an on-time mobility project, so to speak, comparing use of two different types of mobility devices. And what we saw was no matter which device the child started with, there was improvement across all developmental domains. And this article is available in the PT Journal. Trying to think of when it came out. I think it was earlier this year. It might have been last year. You know, it doesn't, probably 2024, now that I say that out loud. Time just really flies by and I lose track. And I told one of my students that the date was 1980 something last week. And they looked at me and I said, oh, I meant 2025. So.
Crazy. Well, one of the things that Hawk, when you asked that question, I know that you found it on our website recently. We haven't actually published or really talked about it a whole lot, but we actually at Promobile, got a bunch of pediatric folks working for us in our marketing department. We created a little landing page. And it's just the whole intention of it is it's not to sell Promobile products. It is, I kept telling the team I was working on, I was like, imagine your child's, you know, you've just been told my kid needs a wheelchair. What happens? And so that's actually something that we're going to work on promoting a lot more, because it walks through like who can you expect to have on your team? What is their role? And we actually at Promobile spoke with, we have a couple of our parents of children with disabilities that work with us. One works in finance. And so we talked with him. It's like, hey, you know, what did you and your wife experience? And really, really go through that to help us understand from the perspective, because even though we're a bunch of therapists, we actually had a pediatric worked for a national provider and worked as an ATP. I don't want to name the national provider, but she now works for us and she specialized in pediatrics, and just really looking at it from a different standpoint, because there's just not enough information out there for families. And I think that's something that we need to be better at, making families aware of, and then just, you know, making clinicians aware of it too. So Hawk, we could talk about this for days, days on end. And I'm sure you're probably like, there's more stuff I need to ask, but I want to make sure we don't run too long. Don't take too much of Lisa's time, but we can probably have her back on at some point to chat more. This is truly a definition of wheelchair nerds when, Hawk, if you come to International Seating Symposium one day and see us all like dorking out on these sorts of things. I always tell people, when you see a wheelchair nerd looking at a wheelchair in public, we're not looking at the person. We're literally looking at the device. We're literally looking at the device.
My husband tells me that all the time. Don't stare. And I'm like, but I haven't seen that configuration before. And I'll sometimes go up to talk to my husband's going, oh, please don't do that.
I mean, I even start doing it now too. So you guys through osmosis kind of caused me to change my behavior too.
Bunch of wheelchair nerds. Hawk, do you want to You want to ask Lisa our favorite questions on how we like to end every podcast?
Yeah, we have a few questions we like to ask all our guests just to kind of compare and contrast. I think I'll go through just a couple since we're low on time here, but what piece of complex rehab technology or equipment do you think is underrated or misunderstood?
Gosh, I can think of several that just kind of pop into my mind. I do think what we might call a power wheelchair standing device, a power wheelchair that electronically or motorized transitions between sitting and standing and can be driven in either position. I think that's definitely underrated. We have done a few small studies here with that, and I just think that that independence and that ability to access the vertical plane to a greater extent is just amazing. And yet it seems like a lot of insurance companies are hesitant to cover it. So therefore, a lot of our local clinicians are hesitant to recommend it. And I can completely understand that, but I'm encouraging them to let's not be the one following what the insurance wants us to practice. Let's try to make the insurance support contemporary practice the way that we as the therapy community involved with our parent and child and user advocates feel it should be, because otherwise we're really going to be stuck into a different era. And I also think that devices such as the Explorer Mini, and there are a few others coming on the market, I believe, for younger children that really look like not like any other power mobility device that you've ever seen, really fun and engaging. I think that those are underrated in terms of the impact developmentally that they can have on the children. The key, I believe, is that idea of having a joystick, where ours are ride on toy cars, have the stop-go button. And you can get a joystick on them. We've done a couple conversions with joysticks, but boy, are they a little challenging. And I think that idea of having a proportional joystick is just a real huge learning key. One of these years, if I have enough research time, I'd like to do a study kind of looking at the difference between using joysticks and switches and kind of looking at them outcomes of learning and things like that.
I would sign on to that one with you. I think we should do that one together, and I'll tell you why. Because I think there's a place for switches. I think sometimes people are afraid to go to because they're like, oh, they want to have portion control, but you can use switches to help learn the concrete left and right. So that once again, that's a whole other sidebar.
So those are the two types of products that I see as right off the top of my head when you said both of them popped into my mind equally.
Great. And then I know a lot of people look up to you in the complex rehab technology world, but who's someone that you look up to who inspires you?
Well, I'm surprised to hear that people look up to me because I'm just a clinician. There are so many people that I look up to. So if I was to think about one person, it would probably have to be Lisbeth Nielsen. She just has really changed how I approach all sorts of learning situations. And, her work has now shown that the assessment of the learning power mobility, so the ELP, is actually universal and can be applied to any learning situation. She's actually going to be presenting on that in Rotorua at the Oceana Seating Symposium in November. But it's just amazing. And I use some of those concepts in my work with my students even, because they can apply to cognitive concepts and things like that. So I think Elizabeth has had a huge impact on my life, a friend and colleague that's just making a difference in so many people's lives as the word and the use of the ELP spreads really through all corners of the globe. And I'd have to say I've had a couple of children that I've worked with in my life that have really made a huge impression on me. It really taught me things that I needed to learn as a therapist. And I'm so grateful and thankful for those children and their families for helping me to continue to learn and grow, not just as a clinician, but as a human being. So I'm really, really excited that I've had that opportunity.
And then last but not least, what makes you a wheelchair nerd?
Oh, gosh. Probably the fact that I can't stop smiling here as we're talking about it. I am the definition of the wheelchair nerd. I want to get down and take it apart, see how I can put it back together. I just feel that we need more people to be interested in being wheelchair nerds. I see my students less and less interested in actually pursuing that seating aspect of practice, that seating and wheel mobility aspect of practice as one of their niches. And so I can really get geeked all out of it, but I try to tone down my geekiness so that my students think it's cool.
Absolutely. Well, Lisa, it has been so much fun. I missed you. It's been too long. You're making me want to go to are you going over to the Oceanica event in November?
Yeah, I'm actually also one of the featured speaker type, I forget what they call it. So I'm really excited about that as well. And I know it's a great lineup. Paula Rushton's going to be there. It's going to be great.
I've got a good friend of mine who works for ProMobile's APAC. She directs, is the director of their APAC clinical education team. Her name is Tilly. She came to ISS this year, and she said to me, she's like, oh, friend, she's like, you need to come down under or come over to when we do the Oceanic seating symposium. I'm like, I know. So yeah. I just need to come into a great deal of money and time, and then I'll be able to go.
This has been great, Lisa. I really have learned a lot. And yeah, thank you for answering all my questions. And
thanks, guys, for having me here. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for checking out this episode. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss a single one. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram. Our handle is @wheelchairnerds. And tell your friends about our podcast, too. Oh, and we really appreciate it if you give us a 5-star rating and leave a comment sharing what your favorite thing about Wheelchair Nerds is. Last but not least, if you have a topic you'd like us to discuss or know a great guest, hey, it could even be you. You could be that next great guest. Send us an email. Tell us why. You can reach us at wheelchairnerds@permobile.com or DM us on one of our social platforms. We love hearing from you. Along with the wheelchair nerds, the wheelchair nerds, the wheelchair.